On our earth, before writing was invented, before the printing press was invented, poetry flourished. That's why we know that poetry is like bread. It should be shared by all, by scholars and by peasants, by all our vast, incredible, extraordinary family of humanity. That was Pablo Neruda. I'm Bob Holman, and this is the Poetry is Bread podcast, where poetry challenges us, makes us think, and with imagination and courage and heart, changes the world. Today, right now, two poets of hilarity and pop wow of economic insights that take on heavyweights, Adam Smith, Karl Marx, and John Maynard Keynes, and win because their poetry is better. I'm, of course, talking about and to and with Jerome Sala and Jack Skelly. This is where we have wild whoops and whistles and...
Hey, no.
There it
hey.
Is. Thank you. Okay, these two gents are old friends. Both have new books of poetry out today, 25th of June, 2023, 21st of June, or whatever, in the year of the motor car. So I have devised this opener where first Jack says, here, here, and then Jerome says, there, there.
Okay, here, here.
There, there.
Figuratively, so to speak, I'm going to give intros to both of these poets, and then they're each going to read a poem, and then we're going to proceed to our podcast, renamed for one day only, Food Fight with Words. Okay, here comes the intro for Jack. There's only one, no, make that two, poets I can think of who blend the sensationalism of the tabloids with the critique and theory of the Semiotext Press, those wonderful publishers. One is Kathy Acker, but she couldn't make it here today. Sorry, Bob, she wrote me. I'm off to the Rockies on my Harley with my boy toy on my back. The other is Jack Skelly, who we were able to lure into our Bowery Poetry is Bread studio today. Pride Day, Parade Day, here from L.A., you know, when I read Seven Deaths in Disneyland in the amazing chapbook, Whammo Amnesia, when I saw this book, Whammo Amnesia, I knew that this was the immediate alchemy I was looking for. And when I read Skelly's other books, I knew I was encountering somebody who was always going to go all the way and then just keep going. Welcome, Jack Skelly. Give us a poem, Jack.
I'm so glad you remember that. Whammo Amnesia. Okay, thank
it's
you,
It's the greatest
Bob.
Title ever until we get to The Complete Fear of K.A.
Right, we can mention that, too.
We can mention it?
Okay. We could. All right, well, I can read a poem. I'll read. Thank you again, by the way, and great to be here with Jerome. I'll read the title poem from my Interstellar Theme Park, New and Selected Writing. So... I'll just freaking read it. This is Interstellar Theme Park, based on Alejandro Jodorowsky's lost epic Dune. Because, you know, the filmmaker Alejandro Jodorowsky never made it. He should have made Dune, because all the other versions of Dune are horrible.
Rahm is an expert on
there
that,
you go.
By the way.
Interstellar Theme Park. I want horror ships. And I want these horror ships to dock in orbital flesh. I want ruby-throated ornithopters sipping the nectar of dwarf stars. I want Emperor Dali on a toilet throne of dolphins. I want drones that say, yes, daddy. I want H.R. Geiger mausoleums for the 27 Club. I want quasi-suspended animation, genital arousal optional. I want a planet of toys. I want a jihad of joys and a gulag of Karens. I want Rambodian grammar police. I want woke Stormy Daniels balloon rides. I want light rail stations of the cross. I want Picasso's pajamas 50% off on all Emporia. I want Vibrators by Dre standard. I want Sid Barrett era Pink Floyd to levitate the Tomorrowland Terrace, you know, at Disneyland.
Yes, indeed.
I want 50-foot Miley Cyrus mourning her dead pets on Dog Star Syria. Miley Cyrus's best album was Miley Cyrus and Her Dead Pets, which is the one she did with, those guys. I want Time Itself to eddy and unhitch from its turntable of deception. I want Moon Juice Cougars. See them jumpstart adaptation, anointed with next-gen Kardashian lips and hips. I want Fruity Pebbles vaccination bars with stalactites nippling jelly bellies, but without the jingle jangle crash. While we're at it, I want fingers that are 17 trillion light years long, probing asteroids and healing hemorrhoids. I want Aristophanes tranny globe beings. You remember Aristophanes tranny globe beings from the Symposium by Plato?
Oh, absolutely. That's where the poets got kicked out.
That's correct. Yeah. Tranny globe beings. They're around. I want Aristophanes tranny globe beings rolling around and layered with eyes. Day and night, without ceasing, they sing. Don't forget, I want on-demand K-holes, ketamine holes, mouthing the words now and wow, drooling and dripping with ahegao. I want rings, blue rings, and rings around rings of Berlin blue orbs. Get me Stanley Kubrick. I want him to edit all humanity to grunts and symbols. On gas giant Neptune, I want Hello Kitty to be Hell Kitty. I want fresh-baked hosts branded with the Holy Ghost. Oh, and I also want biofeedback donuts that induce Satori. I want 12 Lady Gagas to perform Lady Madonna. Each one is pregnant and haloed with 12 stars. I want drunk surfing on a river of anti-gravity. And into this river, I want a comet called Wormwood to crash with cold fire nightly at 9. I want Kali the Destroyer decapitating Parvati from Survivor. I want to occupy octopi and learn their language of shape and texture. I want a sunken palace where the spirits of lost lovers murmur. I want thick, chewy anarchy in a candy-colored shell. I want to live stream apocalypse dreams. I want universal chaos. I want the abyss. And when the singularity finally arrives, or maybe it's here now, and dumb matter rises to gaze upon itself and remember who it always was, I want everyone to defragmentize into their star child, commingle dimensions, and upload into each other's arms.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yes.
Wow. It really is an interstellar theme park.
It is.
Yeah. And I'm telling you, we have a lot to say. And Jerome Sala is going to get to say it, okay? Our next guest, because I am not going to do any commentary, though I will say, Jack, that your footnotes in the oral tradition are called for. So feel free to footnote wherever that path may take.
Okay, great.
Okay,
thanks.
You are super. Let's always remember that, and also remember to never read the numbers if you have numbered sections. Okay. So they're so boring and anti-poetic if you do that. Just take a pause. I hope all you spoken word poets are listening to me now. Okay, Jerome Sala's books of poetry include. I've got to take a drink of water here. Okay, we're back. Sorry about that. I'm human. Jerome Sala's books of poetry include cult classics such as I'm Not a Juvenile Delinquent, The Trip, Raw Deal, Look Slimmer Instantly, Prom Night, The Cheapskates, Corporations Are People Too, and most recently, just out, How Much? New and Selected Poems. Before moving to New York City in the 80s, Sala and his spouse poet Elaine Equi. Elaine, that's a shout out to you. We love you. We wish you were here too. You are. Did numerous readings together, helping to create Chicago's lively performance poetry scene. I know, because I was there. Sala was designated the first world heavyweight poetry champion in a series of poetry competitions staged in boxing rings that were precursors to the Poetry Slam. And I now get to mention that in the wonderful new book by Joshua Bennett called Spoken Word, he gives a shout out to Al Simmons. Actually, he's named like this, a man named Al Simmons. Let me just continue with that quote here. A man named Al Simmons. Where are you, Al? Well, I thought I had it right here, 124. Oh, it's on the next page. A man named Al Simmons. Okay. Even in the 20th century, there are direct antecedents to Poetry Slam that helpfully contextualize its influence and impact. In Chicago, the birthplace of the Poetry Slam format, the scoring the judges chosen from the audience, the three rounds, the cash prize, there was already an ongoing series of poetry competitions sponsored by a man named Al Simmons, who created the World Poetry Association in the early 80s. The WPA put on poetry boxing matches, which took place in actual boxing rings with timed rounds and the like, and would eventually lead to the Taos Poetry Circus. What they failed to mention, and what so many have failed to mention, is that Jerome Sala is the world's first world heavyweight poetry champion. We're lucky to have him here today, along with his blog, Espresso Bongo. More about that later. Hey, Jerome, have you got a poem for us?
Yes. Since Jack and I both share a background in writing advertising, I thought I'd read a poem in the form of a TV commercial. And I'm going to give you some footnotes up front here. This is a rewrite of a commercial done by Subaru. And their idea for this, their commercial, was, let's not talk about a car as a romantic object that's going to give you power, sex, and profundity. Let's talk about it as a utilitarian object that takes you from point A to point B. So I thought, why not write a commercial for poetry that looks at it not as a profound thing that's going to change your life, but a utilitarian object that gives you pleasure?
As it is.
Okay, no. So let me read it. And okay. I'm going to read, like a TV commercial, I'll give you the voiceover on one side and the video and the sound effects on the other. So now, here we go.
Jerome, just to interrupt for a second.
Yes.
You're sure you don't want Jack and me to actually do the sound effects while you read what they are?
Well,
I know I'm putting you on the spot here,
I'm afraid
it's a podcast.
You could give it a shot, but I'm afraid that
Never mind.
Okay.
Just another one of those crazy ideas.
All right. So here we go. And my poem is called Variations on a Theme by Subaru. A poem is just a poem, and its sole reason for existence. Twanging blues guitars accompanied by scrolling type. It's to take you for a ride from the first line to the last with a little pleasure in between. Nude body parts of both sexes, shots of rubber leather fetish toys, pierced genitals montage. It won't make you more handsome. Shot of Katharine Hepburn in sunglasses or prettier. Shot of Montgomery Clift in An American Tragedy, damaged black and white film to connote authenticity. Or younger, shot of Mick Jagger at 75, dancing, swinging with a belt over his head to Jumping Jack Flash. And if reading it improves your standing with your fellow poets, shot of neo-beat types looking impressed in back of person in striped turtleneck reading Howl. Then you live among snobs with distorted values. Neo-beat types frown. A poem is nouns, verbs, articles, adjectives, prepositions, and adverb. Wild exploding type, a la Russian futurist topography. A small machine made of words, shot of William Carlos Williams smiling. And in choosing one to read and reread, the question should be, What kind of jolt will it give me? And can I get a comparable kick in less words, quick sequence of exploding mushroom clouds? Hmm. And do I like the way this machine feels when it races through my brain? Kit shots of 50 science fiction rockets sparkling in space. And do I like the way this poem looks on the page? Shots of concrete poems in strange shapes. And in the end, with an absence of marketing glamour about the poem, shots of Barnes & Noble bookstore exploding. May the best poem win. Long shot, people cheering at a poetry slam. Tagline, poetry, it's what to read. Logo, fade to black.
Oh, right.
I'm sold.
I just wish that Subaru could have put their money where their tires were and let us film that marvelous ad. You know, so what is your guys' history in advertising? I know, you know, I understand somebody just retired recently. I can't believe I'm saying words like that. But talk a little bit about that and the relationship you found between poetry and advertising.
Well, actually, Jack and I have talked about this for a lot over the years. And we found that, first of all, some poets are famous for advertising. There's a rumor that Lou Welch came up with the wonderful line, Raid kills bugs dead, which is a wonderful ad line. And Jack and I have talked about this over the years, and writing taglines and having every word you write supervised by a whole committee makes you very conscious of making every word count and the great kind of effort you have to make every single word communicate.
That's correct. Jerome, you know, was until very recently a high-powered advertising executive here in New York City. But I've labored in those mills as well, but maybe on a, you know, whatever, work for different advertising agencies, whatever. But what he says about the tagline and the concision of language is so true, and I wish more poets would remember that too. Although there's nothing wrong. I also love big, long, sprawling poems, you know, epic poems, whatever, you know, that's those are good poems too. But that raid kills bugs dead. One, two, three, four, five, four words. If you can get that tagline under seven words and you still have some emotion behind it, you've got a poem and a tagline.
We all remember Lou Welch, beat poet, disappeared in Mexico. We read his Ring of Bone. Let's go. Mm-hmm. But another extraordinary thing about raid kills bugs dead is that it's repetitive. In four words, you say something kills and that they're dead.
Right.
I mean, if you kill something, it is dead. You don't, it's obvious, but yeah, you need that fourth. Raid kills bugs. Eh. Raid kills bugs dead.
Oh, yeah.
Now you hear the difference there, you poetry scholars and theorists out there. Oh, yeah. But of course, in both of your, you take that, the advertising world on in your poetry. While taking the ducats from the man, you also are able to give it back to him with your poetry. That's a beautiful economy. How's it feel?
Well, the one thing about that is because what we did for a living involves words, it allows you to play with words in your poems in a similar way and push the work world into the poetry world, push commerce into culture, and just kind of try to dissolve that Grand Canyon between the two of them, to dissolve the void in between two of them. Jack, how did you find that?
I mean, I think that's true. I just always been bemused about the advertising world. We both are, you know, kind of like a love-hate relationship with how it sort of manipulates great masses of humanity. But that's, you know, kind of an evil thing. But if you can kind of stand outside of it, you know, and re-manipulate it or retro-manipulate it or something like that, this can be a lot of fun.
your poetry, yeah, rips the you know, the camouflage off of advertising and lays it bare, as just as you're saying, as the manipulation, re-manipulation of language, which, you know, poets want to do that too, although they want to do it in a very different way. Anybody got a poem that could be talking, that could be useful for that situation where poetry is laying bare the skeleton beneath the big fat Budweiser can or whatever? Name your product.
You know, that in my most recent new and selected writing, Interstellar Theme Park, always show the product and always name the product.
Beautiful.
There's a section called Product Placement, is one of the chapters. So the first poem in Product Placement is a poem called Green Goddess, which Elaine Equi, I think she's going to put that in her next anthology, right?
That's correct.
Here's another plug. For the great, what's it called? The
Best American Poetry
2023 or 2020? Yeah. So what the fuck? So it's called Green Goddess. So I don't know if that conforms to everything you just teed up there, Bob. But
you got it.
Green Goddess, you know, it's definitely a product.
You nailed it.
Okay. Green Goddess. Who made the salad? Whose tangy vinegar made me wince? Who played pouty Venus to my impudent Caesar? Who taught me to renounce meat? Who flowed forth lubricants? Who performed dark sacraments? Whose tart shrub tangled my tongue? Who, with unctuous poses, oiled me? Who received my verdant sacrifice? Who, as I reclined panting, poured herself into her dressing? Who lured me to the garden and dragged me into deep greens? Who instructed me on the use of the proper fork? It's the outside fork and then the inside fork. Who inserted an oblong cucumber? Who shredded slender carrot sticks? Whose burning bush consumed the sky god's timbers, shaking his heavens to the rafters? He's a green goddess, you know. Who roused me in damp chambers, dousing reasonable fires to consume knowledge raw? She's, you know, vegan and vegetarian. Who, at the crack of the vernal equinox, broke seasoned bread into bite-sized croutons? Who parted beet-red vestments? Who swelled my painted cave beast, proud and pregnant? Who put me in the red pepper pink? Whose celestial power would I enviously drink? Who succored me when I lay pallid? Who made the salad?
Oh, always end with a rhyming couplet.
There you go.
beautiful. Jerome, you have a complimentary?
Yes, I do. This is also in the Best American Poetry 2023 that Elaine Equi has edited. This one is called Something I've Not Bought. And what this is, give you my footnote here, W.S. Merwin had a poem, Something I've Not Done. And it was kind of a destiny that followed him throughout the poem. And I thought, how to convert this into today's commodified world? And so I changed it from Something I've Not Done to Something I've Not Bought. And it's kind of like how when you search for a product on the web, it follows you everywhere. The ads follow you everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So this is called Something I've Not Done, Something I've Not Bought, after W.S. Merwin. Something I've not bought is following me. I see it in my Facebook feed, peeping out from the top of my email stream, the stream they promised they'd never sell, owned by a company I don't know well. Something I've not bought is following me. Something, seeing as I've not bought it again and again, I see the tracks of its ads like tears running down my screens. In the morning, it's there on my phone before breakfast. It seems to pop out of the void in a banner above my browser. I shrug off its warnings, tapping a gray tab that says close. In the evening before bed, it knows I've spent a whole day not buying it again and again. Not being a person, it doesn't take it personally. But if I ever click on it, I'll never be rid of it. Hmm. It will inhabit the very soul of my machine, demanding ransom unless I pay or exercise it through a search and destroy mission in my applications file. If I shrug it off, I know it'll be okay. A stranger waving at me from an ocean liner I pretend not to see.
Sometimes they follow me even if I've bought it.
That's what, isn't that what he says? I know it'll be a stranger waving me from an ocean liner. I think he's saying that.
Well,
he's
saying he didn't buy it, and it's still following him, right?
That's right. I say, if you don't buy it, it follows you. But if you ever click on it to buy you'll never be rid of it.
It's coming.
I thought click on it meant buy it, but obviously click on it isn't taking it to your cart and then inserting all that information, getting a password. Mm-hmm.
But if you ever do buy it, it'll still follow you. That's never get rid of it. Right. Yeah.
And that reminds me of that moment in Amarcord where the people are in the boat and that liner is coming straight at them. You know?
Yeah.
What incredible images you manage to pull out of the most mundane and horrific parts of the digital universe. Both of you guys do that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's and to build it on the form of W.S. Merwin, that's also unexpected. You know, the thing about your poetry, which is, you know, so nasty in its approach to the society, and yet using these, using words that are, you know, sheer poetry, is that it seems like it's in a different zone from where William Merwin would be, you know, but you've got it there. Does it, do you have influences, Jerome, from poets who aren't advertisers?
I think we all started out with that moment when, wow, poetry is really cool, is when you first hear Frank O'Hara. Mm. Because Frank O'Hara's walking down the street talking about buying commodities and, you know, hamburgers, liver sandwiches.
Strega.
Yes, Strega, Galois. Yes. All of this suddenly gets into O'Hara's poems. And when you first hear that, it's like, wow, I want to do that. So he's kind of the urtext that all of this flows out of.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, Jerome and I, too. Lots of kind of whatever poets of our ilk or whatever it is. Frank O'Hara was like, you read those I Do That, I Do This, I Do That poems, and you go, fuck, I can do that? You know, and then we do it. And then also, another inspiration for me actually was Jerome and Elaine. So Jerome Sala and Elaine Equity was a big influence on my poetry at a time because they were doing things that I didn't realize I could do, specifically about pop culture, about all the things we're saying, but on the larger stage of pop culture. And I just ran with that, too. They were big influences on me.
Well, that is really interesting because, you know, you are on opposite ends of the country. When, you know, Jerome and Elaine moved to New York. You've been in L.A. all this time. Your book, The Complete Fear of Kathy Acker, is, you know, a dailiness in L.A. in the 80s. And so why don't you, tell me about that scene there, and tell me about how Jerome and Elaine, tell me about that, Jerome, how you got engaged with L.A.
I could start with an anecdote. Oh, by the way, another footnote. I'm not sure if the best American poetry is 2023 edition or 2024, but that we're both
the next one.
It's the next one. It's the next one, whatever that is. So I hate to be inaccurate. The interesting thing is when I was first doing poetry with a kind of performative edge in Chicago, which was extremely pop and punk, there was nobody else doing it till somebody showed me in a small press bookstore Elaine Equi's doing it, and her first book was Federal Woman. And I looked at it and I go, wow. And so we met, we started performing together. Then one day, Elaine and I were in a bookstore. We saw the first issue of Dennis Cooper's, or not the first issue, but one of the issues of Dennis Cooper's Little Caesar. It was the one with Iggy Pop full frontal on the right. cover. Elaine starts looking through it, and there were her poems. And the way that happened is she was in New York before this, and she had given Gerard Malanga some of her poems. Gerard Malanga gave them to Dennis Cooper. He didn't know how to get a hold of Elaine. He put them in the issue. So Elaine wrote to Dennis, and she sent him both my work and hers, and he said, come on out and do a reading. So back then, you know, we were young. We land at the L.A. airport. We don't know where we're going to stay. We call Jack up, and Jack says, well, you could stay at my place. And so the first time we went to L.A., we stayed at Jack's apartment.
In my crummy Venice bungalow, yeah.
The other thing we loved about the L.A. poets was that they were extremely pop like we were. So it was like an amazing connection.
So tell us a little bit about that world, Jack. What was it like then?
So it's funny because it does feed into Fear of Kathy Acker, my new book, but it was a huge, hot and heavy, like creative hotbed of poets, writers, artists, musicians in L.A. at the time. Dennis Cooper was like crucial to that scene. You know, we still now call it kind of the Dennis Cooper gang that existed in early 80s in Los Angeles, because it was kind of led by Dennis when he ran the poetry series at Beyond Baroque Foundation.
Well, you know, which when I heard that was impossible. You know, Dennis's work is so outlaw and out there that to think of him being an administrator at a nonprofit like Beyond Baroque, do you have any idea how that came about?
I mean, yeah, I was right there. I was actually working at Beyond Baroque before he came in. I just happened to be there, you know. And then he came in and really shook it up by inviting people like Lynn Jerome from across the country.
Why did he do that? You know, what I'm saying is it seems like a crossing of worlds. Do you have, you know?
Well, why did he join the...
Why did he become an executive director of a nonprofit when he's an outlaw poet?
Well, I mean, he ran the reading series. He was like the artistic director. So he wasn't like crunching the numbers or anything like that. And he was a poet, and he was very much inspired by poetry, and he had all of a sudden he had a venue to do it. So he did it.
And he not only did it, he did it in the biggest way possible. An amazing scene that was. You want to name some of the... Yeah. Your buddies there?
I mean, it was Dennis Cooper, so Amy Gersler, who is now, whatever, Guggenheim winner, National Book Award, blah, blah, blah. David Trinidad, who's put out dozens and dozens of lived his whole life in poetry, and also has a lot of these pop culture themes that we're talking about. Benjamin Wiseman, who is a tremendous fiction writer. Kim Rosenfield was part of that. She was 15 freaking years old when she came to her first poetry workshop at Beyond Baroque. And she was obviously a star then, and she's still a fucking great writer now. Just got a new book coming out in the fall. Who else am I forgetting? Michelle Clinton was a great poet at that. Bob Flanagan.
Let's stay with... Okay, so there's two. Let's stay with Michelle Clinton for a minute.
Right.
Because, you know, we had her in the United States of Poetry doing this incredible poem called Celibate. You know, I am going to celibate, she said. You know, she seems, again, a voice of a whole different sort, you know. Mm-hmm. How's Michelle?
I haven't talked to her. We've fallen out of touch. We tried to get in touch with her when we were kind of doing some reunion-type things. I heard she's not in the best health, but I'm glad she's still there. She was a very, very dear friend and definitely part of the sort of chaotic creative scene at that time.
Yeah. And Bob Flanagan. Just an extraordinary performer, poet.
Yeah. Bob, so I have an update on Bob Flanagan. So Bob Flanagan was a tremendous poet. Bob Flanagan had the word alive in him, and he was the best improviser I'd ever seen in my life. In fact, I had a band with Bob and with Mike Kelly called, the artist Mike Kelly. And there was all improv. Every song was a 3-minute song, but Bob improvised every lyric. Anyway, his poetry is coming out after... You know, years of you having to buy $1,000 old, books of his because they're out in print. The Fun to Be Dead, The Complete Poetry of Bob Flanagan is coming out later this year.
That's super.
Yeah.
How about Scott Wahlberg?
Oh, yeah, Scott Wahlberg. He was part of that scene, too, a tremendous poet as well.
What was that crew that you guys had going?
Well, I wasn't quite part of that, but the Karma Bums?
The Karma Bums,
yeah,
okay.
That was definitely him.
Yeah. Anyway, it's just an incredible world that erupted and gave,
yeah.
I think, was the voice of L.A., still is the voice of L.A. Speaking of voices, how about having another poem from you guys?
Okay. Where you go?
Okay. Read this. Excuse me. Read this poem here. You know, my own poetry start out extremely pop. Then I started thinking that a lot of this pop stuff is based on money. So I thought it would be fun to start writing poems about money. And of course, Wallace Stevens said, poetry is money is a kind of poetry. So this poem is called On Money and Bullshit. And the way it's written is it takes a cliche. This is a fun way to write a poem. Take a cliche and turn it backwards. So the cliche is money talks, bullshit walks. In this poem, it's bullshit that's talking and money that's walking. On money and bullshit. My bullshit was talking to me when my money walked in the door. I said, hi, honey. What brings you back? And so strong, so adorable. My money said, I heard your bullshit carrying on with flavor and power. And I said to myself, money, go away and bring more of you, more than the law will allow. To which bullshit started talking even more bullshit to please money, who was increasing crazily. And bullshit said, if money weren't money, I'd lock money up because money is crazy. But who doesn't want crazy money, especially when you're a bullshitter? And money said to bullshit, that's why they pay you the big bucks to drive me crazy. And money brought even more money in the door. And I said, between money and bullshit, I don't know who I love best. And they said, in unison, like the Doublemint twins of old. Why choose? Why not both?
Uh-huh.
And each kissed a cheek on my ass.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Love it.
Yeah. You know, Robert Graves said, there is no money in poetry, but then there's no poetry in money either. But I think you've disproved it. How about you, Jack? You got something to...
Well, okay, it's not a poem, but we did talk about Fear of Kathy Acker. So this is the latest book, which is old. This book was actually written over 35 years ago. It's a novel. It's a novel thing. I don't know if you call it strictly a novel. It was published in various pamphlets and magazines and shit over the years, but never published in its complete form until now. It's The Complete Fear of Kathy Acker on Semiotext Press. And it's not it's not poetry, but boy, it's poetic, sort of. I'll read this passage where the character is trying to get to Dodger Stadium. And he's driving around. The whole thing is him driving around L.A. trying to get places or walking. And someone pointed out to me, he never really gets to any of these places. In fact, in this poem, I realized that it all is happening. Probably the whole entire novel is happening in his mind. And I fall back into the warm night and don't think about waking up again to face the morning of traffic and hot sun streaming into my windshield and engine as I drive to work, or the hot sun threatening again to overheat my engine as I ascend the middle lane of Dodger Stadium Way. See, his car might overheat. Threatening to bum out my pop archetype Dodger Stadium experience of the mass imagination. Dodger Stadium is the objective counterpart to the vast field of popular myths in my psyche. Every player is a Homeric hero, and the crowd is the great mass of humanity itself, which receives the game as an historic artifact, cheering or groaning as the players' fates are theirs. As I sit, stoned out of my mind, in the top deck behind home plate, The first and third baselines are my right and left arms. Right and left fields are my two legs. The outfield bleachers are the back of my mind. The top decks are my world-wielding shoulders, hunched and poised. And in the press box above me is Vin Scully, my superego, play-by-play awareness, the voice behind my eyes, moon beyond the storm, my dad out in the garage putting away the tools, cataloging with a maniacal serenity, all things part of a story, all stories part of the doubleheader played out in the Dodger Stadium of my mind. But life is not all just baseball games and stories and bloated theories. The hills of Chavez Ravine, this is where Dodger Stadium is, the hills of Chavez Ravine, once a cozy barrio to immigrants, since bulldozed to make way for Dodgers, are the ineluctable facticity of world injustice which surrounds my airy ruminations, threatens their airy theorems and multisyllabic rhetoric. Yuck. Just like my car threatens to overheat as I drive up Stadium Way. I should have just gone to see the Lakers at the Forum.
Gorgeous, beautiful. And yeah, the whole history of Chavez Ravine and Dodger Stadium is in this book and in a lot of your other work as well. You know, you called, or that the Complete Fear of Kathy Acker, which of course was originally published in different parts,
right.
And at various times you said that wasn't the title of it, and meanwhile Kathy Acker is doing her incredible appropriation work where even her Robe Grier quote that made her famous was written by Kathy herself. And now you're taking this mantle and moving it forward with this book. It was called Autofiction at one time, to get a little theoretical. And then you wrote the piece about the rise of the literary thrill-seeking industrial complex.
Yes, I wrote an article called The Descent of the Literary Thrill-Seeking Industrial Complex, paraphrasing who wrote The Descent of Man? Darwin. The Descent of the Literary Thrill-Seeking Industrial Complex, which now there's this big explosion, you know, of what would they call autofiction or whatever. It's like very first-person kind of transgressive. A lot of it descends from Dennis Cooper. But so that's huge and big now among the sort of the lit set. But I think there was a time back in the early 80s maybe where Kathy Acker was trying to do that kind of stuff before it had a name. And then people like Chris Krauss took up the mantle in her novels, like I Love Dick. It's a freaking crazy book. Like, what the hell is she? Is that real? You know, there's kind of this disjunction between the author and the narrator, where the narrator pretends to be the author and kind of throws the reader off track. And the whole thing is kind of like happening in the mind of the reader as they experience the book. Anyway, that's kind of what was happening with this book at the time, but I didn't realize it at the time because I was just immersed in it.
Certainly were when you yourself become Dodger Stadium and your arms are the foul lines on third base and first base sides, you know. Taking this a step forward, backwards, or at least into digitality, you're using TikTok now as a means for having your poems be transmitted. How the pieces from The Complete Fear of Kathy Acker that you have online are just amazing. I'm talking about the section that is numbered, but the numbers aren't in order. And not only that, you don't say the numbers. Thank goodness you obey the rules of orality, which are, of course, no rules.
Yeah. Not only will I not say the numbers, but the numbers are out of order. They're not in numerical order.
I think if they're not in numerical order, you should read the numbers. Then, that's the corollary.
And they were randomly chosen. Okay, so, but this piece is called TikTok Alarm Clock. It's not from Fear of Kathy Acker. It's from my newest manuscript, tentatively titled Myth Lab, Theories of Eros and Eschatology.
That'll sell. I think you should take my suggestion and saying more of The Complete. Fear okay, of Kathy Acker.
Even more. I'll just read a little part from this TikTok alarm clock, which is a new thing about, from this new other thing, about algorithms and social media and the human race and human evolution, and if the human race is going to make it or not, or if the singularity will save us, or if climate change will destroy us first, and what will happen. And it's all kind of the, speaking of sort of, you know, the commodification and language, it's really infiltrated social media now, you know, like in the way Jerome was saying with his buying poem. So I kind of scrambled it all together in this. I'll just read one short passage, and I will read the number, 27, but it's only like the third one in here.
Okay.
Okay, TikTok alarm clock. Beware the 5-year-long reptilian shitpost. Will precede a bot beast, holed up in Macedonian Discord boiler rooms, serving dark mirror reruns to LARP, scam, ram masses duped into doing their quote-unquote own research, white boomers succumbing to self-flattery, claim to be pilled to the fifth dimension, but in reality are drunk on normative Brexit and vax memes, while Zoomers vibe and vape, inverting materialism where God particles hear your cries and know your heartache and monitor their human selves and ecosystems ripe for augmenting the body and humanity. The body of humanity receives metaphysical Brazilian butt lifts from digital eugenicists.
All right. Now we're talking something else again, as usual. No, but really, when I watched that on YouTube, first off, it ain't your voice.
Yeah, somebody produced that poem as an AI-generated video with AI voice.
Okay, so you collaborated.
Correct.
As a poet.
There's people
with
called, yeah, Deep Snakes, they're called.
Okay, then they actually have the Deep Snakes logo. I
correct.
Didn't have any idea what that was, but somebody, it looks like Kim Kardashian to me, who I don't know who is.
That's Kardashian.
It
correct.
Is. Okay,
yes,
I got good. One. Okay. Yeah. Now, it's holding a snake.
Correct.
And it's. Why, that girl. Well, it took a while to look. It was a bug and tricked her. And its name was Elmer. No. every section, it changed, the image changes slightly.
Right.
There is an alarm clock that keeps going around. It
right.
never goes off.
Right.
And these words are spoken by different voices. It's really incredible. And to me, it is a whole other way of presenting poetry. Poetry, to me, has got to be out in front of the technology, and this is an example of technology trying to keep up with it.
These people, Deep Snakes, are great. They produce all the images, AI, all the voices are AI, and that shit has gotten crazy now, how you can reproduce people's vases and voices. They're doing good shit, yeah.
Yeah, well... And you are in writing the poem that inspires them to come ahead and do that. And it's just really in keeping with with your whole arc, brother. And I don't know if that's Noah's, but it's still sailing. Jerome, are you working at all with AI or anything like that?
No, not at the moment. I have been... writing some poems inspired by TikTok, but I don't have the one that I was going to write.
Just
read
make it up; they'll never know the difference.
Speaking of poetry and commodification, and how money and poetry don't seem to mix, I thought I could read the title poem of my book, which is about how the exceptional thing about poetry is that there's no money in it. I wanted to, and I was thinking in this poem, how much is every other art form is collectible and commodifiable. But if you collect poetry, you still don't make any money. Mm-hmm. So
tell me about it. I've got a 7,000 volume poetry library in alphabetical order that has been cataloged. It's a marvelous collection. What am I going to do with it?
So this poem is kind of on the value of being valueless, called How Much. How much is it worth? The actual copy of Poems by Pierre Rabardet, Frank O'Hara had in his pocket when he wrote, My heart is in my pocket. It is poems by Pierre Ravardi. Probably not as much as Duchamp's chess set or urinal. That's because O'Hara was a painter, was not a painter, but a poet. And you know what that means. While the other arts add value to their objects, conspiring with the world of commodities to nurture the enrichment economy, verse makes its objects worse, relieving them of their worth, casting them out into the world beyond the cave of money-making, into another place that we do not yet understand and cannot name. How much is it worth, the actual heart of Frank O'Hara, the one stripped of its metaphors? Can his heart actually be divested of such accoutrements? Or must we be forever lost in the moist mist on the brink of the heart itself, an irretrievable object? When Shelley was cremated, his heart refused to burn. Mary Shelley carried it with her for years, wrapped in a silk shroud inside a jar. When revered Tibetan Buddhist teachers die, their hearts become relics and are said to bestow blessings, the greatest of which is the knowledge of emptiness.
Ooh. I think that's a poem that's a good sum it up poem. But then you guys always manage to find the bottom line somewhere deeper than that, lower than low. You know, that was the reference, of course, to O'Hara's Why I'm Not a Painter.
Yes.
And Sardines and Mike Goldberg.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Right.
Both of you guys have riffs on not just O'Hara, but I'm thinking about Who litany of the opening poem.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, that's Ginsberg's.
Right.
Howell is, sure. is going like this all the time, you know? So another layer, though, of the way that poetry is allowed to seep into the strange corners that you are illuminating. With these poems, I'm thinking that the George Orwell's book 1984, which is coming up to his 40th birthday next year, we plan to celebrate at the Bowery Poetry Club, and it seems there that kind of speak that they've got there is still being played out now. Does that book have any resonance in you?
1984?
Yeah.
It's amazing that it's 40 years.
It's the 40th anniversary
of 1984 itself, and the book was written in 1948, I think. Right?
Yes, I think it was. Yeah.
Well, I have a Orwellian poem that's written of nothing but corporate cliches, so
I think that is good. The appropriate way to go.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
And the way this poem was written in freelancing and working for ad agencies and corporations over the years. You hear so many corporate cliches that I was working with an art director one day, and he says, if someone lays another corporate cliche on me, I'm going to strangle them. So I said, let's collect them all.
I love these.
And I put them all into sonnets. So here's one that's hopefully people out there who've worked in an office will recognize the language. This is corporate sonnet number 2. I don't know if I still have the bandwidth to think outside of the box. Sure, I'm good at identifying the low-hanging fruit, but innovation, disruptive technologies, that stuff may be for the millennials to decide. Good luck to them. As for me, well, there comes a time in all our lives when you just gotta drink the Kool-Aid and get with the program. Okay, sure, you no longer got the mojo to break down any silos, but at least your morale is no longer in the toilet. I'm still entrepreneurial and proactive. I'm collaborative, competitively priced, and non-reactive.
And that is the bottom line.
There it is. That is totally the bottom line. You know, what I get from this is how both, you know, you're talking about that's something for the millennials to deal with, you know. But in fact, us of a certain age, aging poets, the energy, Jack, that you had there in the 80s is still in your poems today. And Jerome, I know you're not in the boxing ring anymore, but the way that you you know, continue to spew cliche after cliche back into cliche's face is also, you know, I thought at the time that, oh, this is the poetry of young folks. And the thing is, you're still writing like we're young folks. There's something about the energy of that time that is carried with us. I wonder a lot about where are the hippies now that we have fascism as president? You know, where did that go? Well, you know, that went into the toilet, as the cliches say. But as far as the poets go, I think your energy does not fall into elegiac yet, you know? Just saying.
Well, I have a hard time looking back, actually. What about you, Jack?
I've been forced to look back kind of with this fear of Kathy Acker thing, as I've relived all these experiences that the narrator may or not have lived. It is interesting to kind of try to grapple with it again, and but I try not to be nostalgic about it, because I want to be, like you were saying, Bob, you know, still vital and still, you know, I want to be up to date with the kids. Kids today.
You're pushing us to be up to date with you, too.
There you go.
And the reason that poem full of corporate cliches mentions the word millennials is because I'm not like into generational stuff, and I'm very suspicious of these generational labels because they too are a form of marketing hype, you know.
Totally.
So how about a poem from each of you to close this little podcast out here, and so we can all get out to the parade?
You go first, Jerome. I didn't find one.
Okay. I guess I'll read another one of these corporate sonnets, which are in How Much, New and Selected Poems. The idea here is, just like I converted the Merwin poem into commodified language, I convert my favorite Ted Berrigan sonnet into commodified language and corporate language. So I try to translate it into corporate speak.
Which sonnet is it?
It's sonnet number 37 that begins, "It is light. It is dark. You are asleep, and beautiful tears have blossomed in my eyes. Guillaume Apollinaire is dead." The most beautiful sonnet.
Absolutely. I hope you caught my Berrigan reference there at the beginning of the introduction, Sala. The year of the motor car.
Oh, yeah.
Just to tell you that, folks, even as we're talking, we can't stop the footnotes. Okay.
Okay, so this is my rewrite of this beautiful Ted Berrigan sonnet into work language. Corporate sonnet number 9. It is light. I am awake. And horrible fears form a fist in my chest. Steve Jobs is dead. The wild gray night surrenders to the boldly iterative day. I worry that I need vastly better analytic tools to monetize my idiosyncrasies and enhance my progress toward career optimization. My career is my poem. It is light. I am awake. I need vastly better analytic tools to optimize my career. I pin my favorite motivational quotes to the cubicle wall. I school myself with vast analytic tools. It is light. Motivational quotes punctuate the boldly iterative day. I am awake. A horrible fear forms a fist in my career, in my poem, in the thought, Steve Jobs is dead.
That's great.
That's genius. From Apollinaire to Steve Jobs.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
I try to copy the cut up syntax.
Yeah. You do an excellent job of that, even to the point of using some vocabulary, just right. Flipping out the references. You know, it's so interesting to hear the attempt of this poem to make it into lyricism, which Berrigan is just rolling in. And
true.
The question is, does the vocabulary allow it to be called a lyrical poem? I don't know. That's up to you. Audience, write in here. Write us here at BoweryPoetry.com and let us know what you think about the lyricism of the commodification of the sonnet. Okay. Hey, Jack, you got something for us?
Okay, yeah, I'll end with this one. This kind of goes back to your previous thought, Bob, about the generations and the kids today and, you know, whether they're going to kind of pick up the mantle. And it's a poem that makes an argument about parenthood and children and how the forces of evolution, again, sort of work their way into the family structure, perhaps, or the offspring. And so it's called Emo Dad. I wrote this back when my twins were like five. Emo Dad. Mammalian instincts concoct life-changing foolishness with testosterone, dopamine, and serotonin. You know, you get horny and you have kids. With testosterone, dopamine, and serotonin, juicing animal lust into obsessive yearning and the rituals of romance, all to grease the gears of attachment and keep the species churning. This generational trickery continues in the offspring, who comes out so darn cute, he disarms resentment over sleepless nights and dirty diapers, and whose resemblance to his parents so flatters their natural narcissism that they excuse his bad behavior. You know, you've all seen those parents that just excuse any old horrible thing that the kids do. And yet, even the most cynical father, raised on existentialism and punk rock, feels something, somehow, more powerful than hormones and evolution surging through him when his five-year-old gazes up and says, "Daddy, can we listen to the Ramones again?"
I'm Bob Holman, and thank you for listening to Poetry is Bread. Subscribe to our podcast to get notifications of new episodes. Check us out at BoweryPoetry.com. The podcast is co-produced by Ram Devanini and Flavia Roja with Retiplex. Artwork by Fabian Ceruleo. This podcast series is funded by National Endowment for the Arts and New York State Council on the Arts, the Governor of New York State, and the New York State Legislature. Thank you all. Thank you all for listening. Poetry, it goes in one ear and stays there.